EMS Garage is brought to you by EMS Manager, www.emsmanager.net.
You can interact with us via email, emsgarage@gmail.com, or you can call us at 206-984-1622. That's 206-984-1622.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone there. I want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
Hey everybody, welcome to the EMS Garage. This is episode 36, the yet is to be unnamed episode, and you're hearing the family of Gary Wingrove in the background. Hello, Gary.
Good evening.
How are you?
Excellent.
Great. I'm joining you at 11 o'clock my time, which is kind of weird because now everybody else is behind me, which is awesome. Also joining me tonight is Buck Ferris. Hello, sir.
Hey, I'm barely here.
I know. Well, and Buck Ferris, which is weird. You're here twice.
I'm a stereo. It's going to be awesome.
And Will Dunn. Hello, sir.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for joining us tonight. And Fergus McLee. Hello, sir. Can we still call you a minion?
You can call me whatever you want.
Sweet.
I get called a lot worse at work, so.
Right. I love it. So tonight I wanted to talk a little bit about an article that was found on GEMS.com, and it was from the great doctor, Dr. Wesley. He's always writing great articles, and it's more of a peer-reviewed article talking about, the name of the article is, Does Anyone Really Know What Time It Is? And it's studying time devices and pre-hospital providers and how often they're really on time and how accurate they are and what technology we should be using to be measuring time and things like that. So what do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I think that it really depends. There's some things that I don't think are necessarily time sensitive in EMS, and I think a lot of people kind of get hung up on that. Did I start that IV at 8:20 or 8:19 or 8:18? I think those types of things probably isn't necessarily all that significant as long as they're relative and documented well. But I think where we get hung up in actually not predicting the time is in things where there's perhaps time-sensitive therapy. So probably the best example is the onset of stroke symptoms, and where I see people occasionally either report in a verbal handoff or in their documentation, these symptoms started 40 minutes ago or 50 minutes ago or an hour ago. And I think when you start using relative time with that, that's when you lose precision. I think the one time where you need to use precision is perhaps the onset of significant symptoms. This started at 8 o'clock tonight or about 8:05 tonight. And so whenever you're talking about time, then you're using it with some precision. And then instead of people going, it was like, oh, wait a minute, 45 minutes ago, but that was 20 minutes ago. I guess that was, that's where you lose precision. And I think that's one of the times where it does matter. I see and have run into where occasionally people don't even time their procedures because they're concerned that somebody would come back and potentially go after them because their times weren't exactly correct. So they just choose not to time them. I think that's dangerous. And I think that it's perfectly acceptable to use a relative time, except in some of those things that are discussed. And I don't know if really in some of those other situations it makes a tremendous difference, unless there was a part of the article I skipped over.
Well, no. Okay, so let me play a devil's advocate for a minute. So you're saying that after all that time in ACLS class and all those other classes where they're telling me to give drugs every 5 minutes, that I should be just estimating the time?
Well, do you actually use a stopwatch?
Just realize I'm playing devil's advocate and I've never
really
looked
at the
clock. Okay, no, I don't.
I think that they tell you, don't they tell you 3 to 5 minutes?
Well, good point. Very good point.
So, I mean, I think that everything is within a relative bounds. I mean, we're not getting crazy about this, but you know, I've seen some QA systems that have been so pedantic about that. Oh, you've got to give your drugs every 3 minutes. You got to give your drugs every 3 minutes, and you know, they get the medics get beat over the head. So when they're doing their documentation later on a cardiac arrest, when do they time their meds?
Every three
precisely 3 minutes apart. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, really, there's a way to – there's treating your patient, and then there's treating your QA process. And I think that, again, we have to realize that in the concept of emergency medicine that the times aren't going to be exactly precise. And I think that I'm okay with that. You know, besides actually putting a you know, a GPS-enabled or a, you know, a time-enabled watch on your patient – that doesn't matter how we time our things in the field anyway, the hospital's going to be off. If you notice, a lot of hospitals now are using some of those radio frequency set clocks just for that reason, so everybody's on the same page. But I saw sat in on a root cause analysis some time ago where they figured out that was the biggest problem, is that all the clocks in the hospital were slightly off. And by the time they kind of calculated the time difference, it was significant. But I don't know how you get around that unless you have control over all of your facilities.
Well, whose watch has ever been in sync with the LifePak monitor's internal clock with the watch on your wrist? I mean, it's impossible.
Good question. It is technically possible. If you've got dispatch going off of a time server and you've got a LifePak 12, you know, those things are actually designed to, you can upload those daily and they can actually reset the time based on a time server that sits on a computer. Well, you can get within a couple of seconds of each other, but I think that's one of the reasons why we just understand with EMS that those times are going to be ballpark, and I think in most cases ballpark's enough. But you know, Gary's exactly right. You've got to go to some significant effort to actually get everything to line up correctly.
And then it only matters until the battery slows down on something, or I mean, it's never accurate.
And unless you put on a watch on the patient, and everybody uses the watch that's on the patient,
right?
The timing, that's the only way you're going to get what's accurate, and that's only accurate, you know, according to that watch that's on the patient. If a physician or a hospital is using a clock that's not synchronized, it's going to all be off.
Well, physiologically speaking, though, even if you're in a full arrest situation, does it really matter whether Epi was given at 1354 or 1356? I mean,
no.
In the great scheme of things.
And sorry, Buck, I said Gary earlier. I just didn't recognize your voice. No, it doesn't. In the majority of the time, it probably doesn't, except in some of those specific times where we're looking at a three-hour window for lytics.
Well, sure, if you're trying to do a door to needle, or yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, okay, then I'll give you that. But even, you know, I've worked in some systems where it's been drilled into them that they need to make hospital notification as soon as they know they have a critical patient. Well, yeah, I'd rather you actually manage that patient's airway once you recognize that you've got a critical patient rather than contacting the hospital to tell them, I got a critical patient, because that 4, 5, 6 minutes really isn't going to make that much difference on the far end. Really, you know, and there's probably some potential exceptions to that. But for the majority of what we're doing, a relative time is probably okay. But I didn't also read the article maybe as deliberately as I could.
Well, I think Dr. Wesley is really pointing out the point that, well, and maybe the article actually pointed out too, that mainly the cell phones that the providers were using had a better time according to the atomic clock than anything else that was being used. And so he said, the bottom line is we need to get serious about documenting that time, and the authors have demonstrated great discrepancy. But the absence of the system of synchronization with the atomic clock, your cell phone is an excellent timepiece. So maybe
if your cell phone happens to do that, my BlackBerry doesn't do that.
No, and neither does my Motorola. So, I mean, yeah you're but right. It has to be the cell phone against the cell phone tower that does it.
Right. But, you know, I've got a Garmin watch that's GPS that I use for training, and that's locked in GPS to atomic time. And I noticed, like, you know, my laptop, which has constant internet connectivity, also seems to be updated. And there are some systems that will run a time server somewhere, so everybody's on the same time, regardless of what that is. When I worked in the privates, that was handy when we were timestamping tapes for, you know, if there was a dispute on a scene time or something along those lines, to be able to go back and say, all right, the times that you're hearing on these timestamps for dispatch are atomic clock times. I think there's another significant type of thing if you've got a contractual obligation for times. But from clinically, I think Buck's exactly right. Whether you gave that epi at 2028 or 2026, you know, as long as you're getting an estimate where you're getting close, I think is pretty much clinically acceptable and medical legally acceptable, that you're working under duress, you're working under an exigent circumstance, and that your times might be off by a minute or two. That's perfectly acceptable.
You know how this gets done, though, and this is a QA person speaking. You look in the wheel well, you count four epis and three atropines, and you go, okay, and you go do your paperwork. And that's probably bad. I have to admit, though. I mean,
you know, there's some ways around that. I mean, you know, some of those, you know, have a code marker, and I also worked for a system where they actually voice recorded. For cardiac arrest. Boy, that was exciting listening.
And well, let's talk about that for a minute. What about that Philips system where a cord comes out with a pad on top of the patient and actually measures how you're doing CPR on the patient, tells you whether to do it faster, tells you whether to do it slower, and records the audio inside the cab? Does anybody know anybody using that system?
I haven't, but that sounds – I mean – boy, more often than not, things that are being recorded are awkward.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. I mean, nobody wants to use this thing. I don't know anybody who has a Philips monitor who's actually purchased that package. And, you know, people don't want to deal with it. People don't want to, you know, record what happens with a CPR in the back, although it seems kind of nifty on paper to some people.
Well, you know, I think that the people who are do QA at gunpoint love that.
Yeah.
I'm a QA guy. I'm seriously, my job is QA at the service that I work, and I don't care. I don't want to hear that.
But you're because you are a reasonable man. But I think that I've worked at systems where it's like you feel the crosshairs coming on you. You know, I worked for a system once where I documented my nitroglycerin as 400 micrograms, because I think once you get less than half a milligram, that's a little bit, I think that's how critical care medicine generally does it. Oh, they had a heart attack. You get 400 micrograms of nitro? Oh my God, you have to come in and change this. And I'm like, to what? To milligrams. Okay. Wow. So, I mean, there are some places that do QA by gunpoint, and those are probably the people that want to voice record.
Yeah. And it sounds like my boss.
Well,
<Ooh.
laughs> he works for a different place.
But Gary has – Gary, how do you guys do it at Mayo? You said you synchronize every shift?
Yeah, I don't – I can't tell you exactly how the crews do it, but they do it. I'm trying to find an article here.
So it's like a World War II movie where they all synchronize their watches before.
No, that is a spy movie. There's a spy movie. I'm synchronizing my watch so we can go in and infiltrate the Russians.
No, the dispatch centers and the defibrillators and the EMR system all get synchronized.
Well, yeah, and there's methods of doing that. It takes a little bit of effort, but you know, I used to work in a larger system where there was clocks that were, you know, all the clocks within the building were atomic time, and we asked the crews to make a reasonable effort to come close to that. But you know, we also tried to get on board with the hospitals. This was when some of the hospitals that I was working with were doing accreditation for the chest pain Society of Chest Pain, Society of Critical Care. I can't remember what, which was where that was one of the things that they were trying to recommend, is that everybody. You know, it's not that expensive to buy some of these atomic clocks and use them for some clinical benefit, whether your employees choose to or not, or whether they choose to actually look at their watch every time they're doing a procedure is debatable. But I don't think we necessarily have to hold them to the standard where somebody's holding a stopwatch or looking at a watch. It's certainly a nice luxury, but more often than not, there's probably other stuff that needs to be done other than that.
Well, the reason, you know, it used to be I didn't really care who was right. I just used to sync my watch to dispatch time in the morning. Because if you were 10 minutes off and you were looking at your watch while you were charting stuff, especially for shoot times and stuff like that, that just equaled you being in trouble. So, you know, at least try and keep with dispatch time. But if dispatch isn't following atomic time, basically they're the keepers of the timestamp and everything. You got to be with them. So.
Well, I think you're right. I think you probably have to line up with somebody. It is simple enough now where there is, but you know, with the internet, where you can synchronize to an atomic clock fairly automatically. And if your monitors are being plugged in and uploaded with any reasonable amount of diligence, that's something that can happen. I think I would recommend it. I think, I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think that you want to go away from that type of precision, but I don't think we necessarily need to demand it in every situation.
And see, all of our servers sync every day to our laptops that then, when they're hooked up to the Bluetooth on the LifePak 12, sync. So, I mean, at least all of those things are synchronized the same, which is good for our service, but still, it doesn't help the medic with the stopwatch or the wristwatch and things like that. But I think back on my career, I look at all the times on the LifePak or whatever and go back to those and go, yep, that's what I'm going to use for my times. Makes sense?
Yeah, except, I mean, you certainly get that awkward time around time change where your LifePak's off an hour.
Ugh, that's annoying, but hopefully you've thought through it and changed it, but...
Well, how often that is a very commonly discovered thing a couple of days or a week afterwards, especially if you've got a monitor that's a backup, that if it's not being synchronized regularly is going to be an hour off. But I think that's also very reasonable to defend if you ever get called on it, on why your times are off from your monitor versus your PCR. You can say, that was a clock that didn't get synchronized. I don't think, I'll throw it out to anyone else on the podcast. Anyone else know of any time there's been trouble based on times other than when the crew decided not to put them at all?
I do know of an instance where a guy got fired for putting down times that they went back and found were incorrect, and they said he was charting incorrectly, but they were looking to get rid of him.
That's a common excuse, though. I mean, hey, you lied on your documentation. See you later.
Yeah,
but see, I would argue that that's not times is something that's recognized in the medical legal community as being relative,
right?
And I think that you could all. That was a guy that, yeah, they were looking for a reason to get rid of him. They would have found something
due to
else.
That, yeah, due to that, at this particular service, everybody writes almost. Well, of course, this was a while ago, so not all the new guys do it. But everybody writes times are approximate on their chart.
But you know what? I've seen that. I think that that's. I see people that do that. I think it's a waste of a sentence because it's understood in emergency medicine, at least certainly in most places, that your times are always approximate. But I can understand why they're doing that if they used it to ice somebody.
Yeah, things are run different in Kentucky.
Can you use that like a sundial and a calendar or what?
Yeah. Hand crank, maybe.
At my service, we use electronic PCRs, and we were told when they first brought them in that the now button, N-O-W, now button, would be our friends. We were told to, you know, if you did something, if you had time, you know, put them on the monitor, you gave a drug, press the now button, and it records the exact time of on the computer, which is provided from the server, and I have never had an issue since I started using the now button. So
it sounds like what is that, Office Depot?
No, that's a staple.
Staples. It's a staple. This is a staple.
Oh, the easy button.
Yeah.
Easy button.
Easy. Yeah. I'm so easy.
When you hit now, what does it do? I mean, it doesn't read your mind.
No. Every time you sync our computers, it it updates the time from the server, which gets its time, I believe, from some sort of atomic clock or national. It gets it from somewhere. Right. And so the computer is updated every day constantly. And when you press the now, you know, if I select from the medication list, nitroglycerin, and I press now, it records the exact moment down to the second of when I gave it.
You push the now button. No, it records the exact second when you push the now button.
Right. Which,
yeah, it doesn't correlate at all to when you gave it.
Well, and that's...
Really, it doesn't. I mean, if there's an approximate that you said, all right, but you didn't probably spray the nitro and push the now button simultaneously, I'm going to guess.
You're correct, but it
how
is
funny would that be?
It is within 2 seconds.
Oh, geez. Here we go.
It is within 2 seconds, so.
Well, your 2 seconds, my 2 minutes. I'd get at the end, I'd go now. Yeah. And then figure it out later.
Yeah, but your 2 seconds could be a 6 second error.
So, I mean, that's the, again, and Fergus, bless your heart for coming onto this podcast. I'm busting your chops just because I can.
Oh,
really, it doesn't. It only marks the second you hit the now button. That's the only thing it tells you.
And that's true, but I don't make a malicious attempt to give a medicine and then press the now button arbitrarily.
But I might. I mean, you wouldn't because you're an upstanding paramedic, but somebody out there potentially could. I mean, all that tells you is when that button was pushed.
Oh, gosh.
Agreed. But so far, it has allowed me the opportunity to not visit my QA officer, and that makes me happy.
Is your QA officer on the call?
What?
Is he on the call?
No.
Actually, not me.
No.
Oh,
okay. No, his boss is a little more Orwellian than mine is. So yeah.
Is the world always coming to an end?
I would say yes. More Stalin.
Excellent.
All right.
So the bastard child of Orwellian and Stalin.
I got confused though. This was about time. I thought we were talking about STEMIs and things.
Oh,
tonight.
We are next. That's coming
I thought
up.
We right. did too. That's the only reason I'm here.
Yeah,
because Fergus's service just rolled this out where they're doing this now, so you can
see. Well, it seems like we're out of time for this topic. Ha ha ha. Sorry.
Oh my god.
Sorry, I had to say it. And then, but I did want to do our product of the night. Our great supplier of all things good and informational. Can you guess what it is? Anybody? Oh, come
on. The BBC?
Hey, Chris, I have a guess.
Okay, I bet you do.
It's Ninth Brain.
No, EMSManager.net. Sorry, they're a competitor of the other one, though. No. Ninth Brain isn't. No, Ninth Brain is a CE thing, aren't they?
Ninth Brain does everything but scheduling. Ninth Brain's awesome. So I don't know if they're a competitor or not. But the more I use Ninth Brain, the more impressed that I am. And I'll give them a plug anyway. I didn't mean to subvert your advertising message. And I hope they're not a competitor for our sponsor. But
I don't think they are.
Ninth, if anybody's looking to have something that organizes certificates and continuing education and personnel records for EMS, Ninth Brain's the way to go.
You know, Buck, while he's talking about this, I'm thinking maybe we should have him on the podcast for Educast, and we should talk about technologies like Ninth Brain and CenterLearn and things like that.
Awesome.
All right. Let's do
it. Just tell me one.
All right. Let's do that. But first, we're going to talk about EMSManager.net. I don't think that they're a competitor of the other, but if they are, I recommend EMSManager.net. They're a great sponsor of our podcast. This is their last night for them to be a sponsor. If you really have enjoyed them and you have tried their product, please give them a call and say, hey, I heard you on the EMS Garage. We want you to keep supporting them. Dave's been great. I think we're going to continue on. But I'm just giving us this plug for this. Go to their website right now. You can sign up for a free demo, EMSManager.net. Give them a call the next time you can during normal business hours, 888-749-5550. Optimize employee scheduling, improve efficiency and communications, save money. all with emsmanager.net. Now, we're going to talk about the article from EMS1.com, and it was talking about STEMIs, and for some stinking reason, I can't find the article, so... I don't know why I can't find that stinking article. It's driving me nuts. But if you can, go ahead and start talking about it. And I think the premise of the article was talking about STEMIs and the age disparity and the sexual, well, the sex disparity, not the sexual disparity, but the sex disparity of what providers at least perceive when they're treating potential STEMIs and things like that, that sometimes people don't have the exact same symptoms and things like that compared from the average, you know, 45-year-old male that has crushing left chest pain versus a, you know, maybe a 55-year-old female that has a right-sided chest pain or jaw pain or something that's very abnormal. So what do you guys...
Well, who was the guy on the email list that went off on a rant on this? Because I found it very informative.
That was Nick Newdell.
Where's Nick?
I don't know. I told him he should be here, and he's not here, so I don't know what he's doing.
He sent some vague, rambling email disavowing. I don't know, but yeah, it was not good.
You didn't like Nick's email? I kind of felt his pain there a little bit.
No, I mean, I liked his email. I think he's clinically savvy, but where the hell is he when, you know, it's time to talk?
When it's time to talk, he's not here. No, the whole STEMI thing just bothers me. Why only STEMIs? I'll pick from his email. And that's what caught my eye about this. Like 20% of MIs don't even show up on a 12 lead. And then there's STEMIs, and then there's the difference between you know, angina, and just it's a big problem. But I mean, is this bothering anybody else, or why have we just done STEMIs? Why do they get everything?
I think that the reason why they get the attention, because that is, if there's going to be the dramatic presentation of I need intervention, I need it now, it happens to be the ST elevation MI. And I think that that's easy to see. It's an easy diagnosis to make. Any reasonably trained paramedic should be able to do that. And I think that that's why, because you can see that and you can latch onto it and you can take a big bite out of it. Now, that being said, I think that you should really be concerned that your patient's having an MI way before you put the monitor on them. Now,
sure. And what kind of percentage out of all the people having an MI, and I don't have these numbers, I didn't look them up, I feel bad, but out of all the people who are having an MI, how many of them present as a STEMI?
Well, I don't know that number, but I think, I mean, acute coronary syndrome, you know, is the umbrella term for the ST elevation MI, the non-ST elevation MI, and kind of that unstable anginal group, that group that's going to need some sort of intervention. But really what you're looking at is criticality. You're looking at the time. You're looking at if you're in a large urban center and you're trying to triage your patients, the patient having the ST elevation MI is having the most acute, most profound changes. So I can appreciate that.
Yeah, I just think you're missing – well, the big term here is unstable angina, and that's not a EKG term.
Nope.
That's not even a blood test term.
No, that is a clinical
decision.
But that also, and I would call that lower risk, lower priority. Right? I mean, if you're looking at – I'm not saying that patient isn't sick, but if you've got a patient who – doesn't have a measurable troponin, and certainly, and field troponins is something we can talk about, but 3, 6, 9-hour, 12-hour troponins is negative, no ST changes, no in a relatively bland EKG, then chances are that's a patient that is not necessarily the priority when you are trying to make some decisions about transferring patients, about who's getting what resources, who's getting what. And I think
that's
where you get that.
What's the price tag on a field troponin nowadays? I seriously haven't looked this up in probably 7 or 8 years. How much does it cost to outfit a rig?
Good question, but who cares?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a big rollout. I mean, let's say, Skip's watching a hockey game. But if a Skip Kirkwood wanted to roll out this thing, my God, he'd have to have a federal grant and like $250,000.
And then he'd piss all over it. But what you've got is but you've got a situation where troponin, somebody could be having an acute MI, acute ST elevation MI, be defibrillated and go to the cath lab, be resuscitated, go to the cath lab, get cleaned out, and not have a measurable troponin. It's unlikely, but it's possible that you won't get a measurable troponin off the field blood because the troponin isn't there yet. So, I mean, you can have somebody with a dramatic presentation where the troponin isn't necessarily measurable. I don't really know necessarily what the field troponin's going to buy you, depending on...
Again,
Wouldn't you hope that your paramedics are looking at a patient and go, wow, I'm worried that that guy's having a huge MI. I hope he's not, but I'm worried that he is. We're going to do this, 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 and this. Oh, yeah, we're going to put him on mono. We're going to shoot a 12 lead and go, wow, you know what? His 12 lead's pretty normal, but that guy looks like the guy that's going to just kind of close his eyes and say, farewell, fellas, and rest. I mean, certainly clinical presentation should take priority. Well, I shouldn't say take priority, but use your diagnostics in the context of your patient's presentation.
And we're back to actually paramedics actually diagnosing MI in the field, which is what everybody hates to begin with. That's why I don't like STEMIs. I'm on your side. I mean, I was playing a little devil's advocate in there, but I really don't care whether you have an I-STEP monitor on the or that little brick on the ambulance. I don't care. I care about unstable angina, and I care about a paramedic looking at it and recognizing it and go, oh, crap, you know, this is an event that needs to be investigated right now. I'm going to call ahead of the hospital. And if he really looks like crap on a frying pan, I would like to bypass the ER and go to the cath lab. And I don't need an EKG to say that. I don't need a troponin level to see that. I need my brain. And
You know, there's some risks to cardiac catheterization.
And there are. I mean, you come up with a set of criteria.
Yeah.
And they might include some of these toys.
But I mean, do you guys use a criteria for diagnosing an ST elevation MI in the field in your area?
Fergus.
Yeah.
Fergus does.
You're up. Now, Fergus does it. They just unrolled this. So.
Unrolled or rolled it out.
So, Fergus, tell us about this program. It sounds wonderful. A couple of years old. Please, I can't wait. No, go ahead. You
put me on the spot. All right, so
no, it's awesome. I can't wait. So please start.
We get sent to a call. We get on scene. We take a 12 lead. If we see ST elevation in more than two contiguous leads, we can send it to the hospital through our electronic PCRs. And they can, at this point, they can give us the order by calling our dispatch saying, yes, the doctor can, saying, yes, we agree, this is a heart attack, skip us, go straight to the cath lab. Now, it actually just rolled out less than 10 days ago, and we've yet to be told to pass up the ER, especially at 2 in the morning when I work. But ideally, yes, eventually we will totally bypass an ER. The doctor in the ER will see our EKGs from the patients before we ever get there.
Well, can I tell you what they're doing in the Front Range of Colorado?
No, please. I'm sure we just got this. I mean, it's our new toy, but we're still behind, I'm sure.
There are some systems that have been doing this for 10 or 15 years where the paramedic looks at the EKG, goes, this is an ST elevation MI, calls the hospital and says, I got an ST elevation MI, and they say, go to the cath lab. And it certainly there is a element of trust that has to happen within that system that the paramedic can, A, know what he's talking about when he's calling it, and B, that the system responds in the way the paramedic's calling it. But it eliminates that. It eliminates two things. It eliminates that transmission of an EKG to someone else, which some people would argue is a waste of time. And it also eliminates that decision, that waffling, it sounds like, in your system. At least that's what my sense is of, yeah, we've got, we here it is. We could send you to the directly to the cath lab. See this behind glass. We could do that if we want to. And in not every hospital is set up necessarily to do that, but at least in many along the Front Range of Colorado, it's one of the places where the paramedic looks at the 12 lead, makes the call, and bypasses the ED and goes to the cath lab. I'm not sure that's the best thing for the patient in every situation, but it certainly is impressive to take your patient through the ED right to the cath lab and hand them off to an interventionalist. That's an impressive thing.
Well, and let me play devil's advocate a minute. Here's the premise. Don't all cardiac patients deserve the same treatment regardless of whether they're STEMI or not? And 70% of heart attacks don't have chest pain. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that line, but all chest pain protocols should be outlawed. I'm just reading some comments from the chat room, but so I don't know. I mean, I guess my thought is, and I found the article, it's on EMS1.com. It talks about gender disparities in EMS, and it's a Reuters article that was done, and I'll post a link on the website, but basically saying that not only in STEMIs, but women are less likely to receive medication for chest pain than men.
Aspirin.
Because we've done a horrible, horrible disservice to women in treating acute coronary syndrome.
Right.
Women are designed to tolerate pain. And that with the utmost respect, having watched my wife go through active labor for 8 hours with Mitch. And it was impressive to me that what she could tolerate, and it gave me a whole new appreciation for really realizing that women just deal with pain differently than men do.
Right.
And if you're asking your patients, are you having chest pain, and they say no, you're asking the wrong question. And I think that was kind of Nick's comments that were up in the email, is that we should be looking at anginal equivalents as opposed to, are you having chest pain? Well, no. Okay, next question.
Right.
You know, the other thing that I see that's underassessed is patient populations that are at risk for acute coronary syndrome, patients with HIV, patients with crack or powder cocaine use, patients who are morbidly obese or with significant risk factors, where we're blowing them off or we're not treating them or we're not taking them seriously because of their age. So women is just one component of patients that we have, as a medical industry, if you will, not done a good job with. But there's other people out there that we've also not done our best with.
Okay, so, well, I agree with you. So tell me, so let's get back on this idea of STEMI. I guess that wasn't as heated as I thought it would be. Do you think that all patients, wouldn't you agree that all chest pain patients should receive the same treatment?
No, I don't think you do, because I think that there is certain risks to interventional cath that you may not necessarily want to subject your patient to unless they really need it.
In the field.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because you're right. Once they hit the door of the ER where they can do stuff, then there's a much different thing. But where we're giving, hey Buck, are you okay there?
Yeah, no, I'm cool.
Okay,
I'm cool.
All right, you're just all excited to talk. So because you want to make a point. So continue on this. So once they hit the door of the ER where they can do things, but our treatment is pretty much the same for chest pain, unless it's a slow heart rate, fast heart rate, something that is out of the norm for things.
Unless it triggers like a communication protocol, like it does in some places where we promise, if we use, at least in the Denver metro area, if we use the words cardiac and alert in the same sentence, it means that we've got a patient that fits into this little box. Certain age, certain descriptions, certain ST changes on their EKG, and certain things aren't present, like a left bundle branch block, for instance. But yeah, I think ultimately when you are dealing with the patient, you shouldn't let the monitor tell you whether or not the patient's having, you know, unstable angina or an NSTEMI or a STEMI. I think you should make up your mind long before the monitor goes on that you're going to treat the patient for acute coronary syndrome or you're not.
Good point.
Well, here's something that's always bothered me over the years, and I've asked many people this question, and I've gotten many bad answers and a whole bunch of conflicting viewpoints. But you take one chest pain patient in, and they'll sit on it, send them upstairs, and have them take a stress test. You take somebody who looks very similar to that, they'll try Retivace or something like that. You take another person who looks just like that, and they'll send them to the cath lab. And I'm all about paramedics taking people to the right department or starting the right team, because I think one of the only things that a paramedic may be able to make a difference with is taking your patient to the right place, period. I'm going to psych with this patient. I'm going to OB with this patient. I'm going to cath lab with this patient. Sometimes going somewhere other than the ER is a good thing. So with so much argument about that, what makes a patient a stress test, a cath lab, or whatnot? I mean, what am I missing here? I've asked this question many times and have gotten weird answers.
Here's my perspective, if I may, Buck, is that if you're in a system that has multiple facilities that has different specialties, they probably have different protocols on how they handle this stuff. But, door to balloon time and a lot of different cardiac-related stuff is publicly reportable. So at least in my area, most hospitals come up with some pretty significant protocols on how they're going to deal with this stuff. But I still think you get some hospitals that that lean towards one way of dealing with something other than another. But really, you've got some patients that probably fit into a clinical criteria where they do get selected for a treadmill, where they've got kind of a presentation that doesn't feel as acute. Maybe it's somewhat labile. Maybe their symptoms resolved while they were in the ED. Who knows? But there was something about them that seemed subacute. So what they are trying to do is recreate that clinical scenario to see if they can figure out what that is. But maybe you've got that person that's it's their third, fourth, fifth time presenting in the emergency department with these vague yet somewhat reminiscent complaints of acute coronary syndrome, where it's like, you know what? It's probably time. It's probably time to take you somewhere and have somebody look inside your coronary arteries to see if that's what the problem is. But ultimately, I think that for the most part, if you take somebody into a hospital, not department related, that's having an ST elevation MI and probably 2 millimeters or more in the precordial leads and 2 or more contiguous leads and maybe 1 millimeter or more in the V leads is generally what places recommend, or 1 millimeter even the posterior leads. Those patients ultimately are treated the most aggressively. That could be lytics in a facility that doesn't do interventional cath. That could be that could be going right up to the cath lab in facilities that do have interventional cath. But I think that it is a balance between the facilities that are available and the acuteness of the patient's presentation. And you can have somebody that looks pale, cool, diaphoretic, where you're going to bet your paycheck that they're having an MI, put them on the monitor, they're having an ST changes, and really what they're doing, and this is rare, but it's possible, is that they're having a AAA, and it's dissecting back up through the aortic root and basically into the coronary arteries. So taking that patient directly to a cath lab, the one that's dissecting, that could potentially be a lethal decision. And again, I'm maybe a little bit of devil's advocate, but that's why I'm not 100% convinced, although I've done it and it feels great to bypass the emergency department. I don't know if we're necessarily doing the patient a favor in every instance of bypassing the emergency department.
Wouldn't a doctor miss that aneurysm too, though? I mean, it doesn't matter who's doing the diagnosis.
Yeah, but I think that you got to – yes, potentially that could be missed. But I think that what we're doing as field providers is we're going to promise you that we're going to do – if we're going to call something in the field, that it's going to fit a certain criteria. But I think that, again, the where are the risks? And I think that if you've got somebody that's got a great story for an MI – and they've got an ST elevation MI, well, it's very consistent with that. And that's very reasonable to take that patient directly to a cath lab. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. But again, I don't know, well, you know, and it really kind of depends what happens in the ED. If you're going to wait and you're going to do a chest x-ray in the ED to make sure they're not having, they don't have a widened mediastinum, then you're probably not doing your patient any favors by stopping in the ED. But if you've got an ED that's dialed in that says, okay, we're not going to start glycoprotein inhibitors. We're not going to start a heparin drip in here. All we're doing is we're just going to make sure that this patient's appropriate to go from our emergency department to the cath lab, and they're not trying to do anything else they're cutting off clothes essentially, and somebody is making the call, do we go to the cath lab or not? And that may be because the interventionalist, the cath lab may not be ready yet. I don't know what happens from a risk management standpoint from a hospital of bringing a patient through the emergency department. And I'm not saying it's wrong, and we've been doing that for trauma, at least in many areas, for years and years and years, where the paramedic sees a field presentation and makes a call. And there's at least one hospital in Denver where you do bypass the emergency department and you go straight to a surgical suite. I don't know of anyone else that does that. I'm sure they're out there. But again, what are the risks of taking that trauma patient who you're worried is really, really traumatized straight to surgery? Probably not that much. Okay, maybe you overcall it and they say, well, maybe this patient doesn't qualify for surgery. All right, we're going to downgrade this. But what happens if you take that patient that for whatever reason is mimicking an MI, or the paramedic completely blows the call, God forbid, blows the call, goes through the ED, takes it to a cath lab, and it's something that's completely inappropriate for an interventionalist, and there's a bad outcome for the patient, bad news, or the cardiologist is the interventionalist looking at this paramedic going, this patient doesn't meet our criteria, then the integrity of your system's blown.
Well, then I wanted to ask you about Colorado because, you know, Fergus's system, they just started this, so there haven't been a lot of pissing matches yet. But how many false positives do you get? Because I'm looking at some high muckety-muck cardiologist and a whole team who was on, you know, 15-minute call or pager or something. And they got called and you pulled the trigger on, you know, I don't know, $20,000, $50,000 worth of equipment and people being brought to your side and there was no need for them. You only have to do that a couple of times before somebody gets so mad they'll never let you do it again.
And do it in the middle of the night and that becomes even more acute.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
However, it was at the point where, and I sat in on one particular facility's, the management for the hospital had a cardiac, I can't remember what they call it now, but all the players, including EMS, met once a month to review the cases that had been brought in the month before. And far and away, they complained more when we missed that ST elevation MI in the field. There were so few positives that I don't even remember discussing any in the year and a half that I went to those meetings. But where there was a constant discussion is, how come this paramedic crew didn't call cardiac alert? I don't know. I'll look into it. Gee, that wasn't from our service. Well, somebody needs to get a hold of these people and make sure they're properly trained so they're on the ball. And the reason why is because when it was called in the field, it cut the door to balloon time by 60, 70, 80%. It was dramatic, publishable, publicly available results and how it improved their system, to the point that that's actually one of my regrets, that I didn't get a chance to really get that data pulled together and publish it, because I know that there's lots of systems out there that are doing transmitting 12 leads. I don't know of any, I'm sure that there are, but I don't know of very many other places than the Front Range of Colorado where the paramedics are calling it from the field. And it took a while. I'd say that really the protocol that was in place included things that actually made it more difficult to actually say this patient meets criteria, where one of the things that we did is there had to be reciprocal ST changes in addition to the direct ST elevation, which is a little bit more rare, but far more diagnostic. And so there were fewer initial cardiac alerts. And once we got the cardiologists on board and said, okay, we can do this, and once there was a relationship between emergency medicine and cardiology, the program literally just mushroomed in popularity to the point now where it's a success story on how well things can be done when you're looking at EMS and another discipline besides emergency medicine, besides surgery.
Nice. Well, gosh, you guys always bring so much to the table here, and I feel really dumb sometimes when you guys are on, but you guys just blow me away. So I guess the story is that we have to treat everybody the same with the understanding that we should have a high sensitivity toward STEMIs. Is that a good analysis of what you said?
I think sure. STEMIs are the no-brainer
right.
of the group.
Right.
You know what? That's exactly right, Buck. I lecture into the crews that I supervise that, you know, the decision for acute coronary syndrome isn't made with the monitor.
Right.
Acute coronary syndrome is determined by good history and physical exam findings, and that's when you make the decision. And you can certainly make it much more fancy once you put the monitor on. But it drives me crazy when I see a split crew, an EMT basic and a paramedic crew, where they hand the patient off to the EMT basic once the monitor is put on and they, air quotes,
clear.
Confirm that the patient isn't having an MI, which is
crap.
Poor care in my opinion. I don't see it at the service that I'm at now, but I saw it at previous systems that I supervised, and I think it was because it was the easy way out. The monitor doesn't tell you that they're not having an MI, but it may tell you that they're not having a huge, massive MI where you should tell them to get their affairs in order. And put on the combo pads and start 3 IVs and start cutting off clothes. But you can certainly, I mean, that's almost, and I hate to say it's the word reassuring, but the dramatic presentation aren't the ones we miss. It's the subtle presentations. It's that 57-year-old. It's that 26-year-old HIV patient. It's that 20-year-old morbidly obese patient. It's the subtleties that we miss. And those are the ones, those are the patients that actually we can probably help the most. And that's where we do our patients a disservice by not treating them with a high level of suspicion.
Nice way to wrap it up. So, well.
Not that I feel strongly about it.
Not that you feel strongly about it at all. You know, I love when you come on, Will, because you're very passionate about the things you do love, and STEMI and Airway and a few others. And I love having you on. And so, Will, do you have anything coming up soon where you're going to be teaching? Is the difficult airway course coming up, or are you done with that?
No, difficult airway course is actually this Friday in Medical Center of the Rockies. If you happen to be in the Front Range of Colorado, it's right off the Loveland Exit. Medical Center of the Rockies is a brand new state-of-the-art hospital, trauma center, acute coronary syndrome center that's part of the Poudre Valley Hospital System. They are gracious enough to be hosting the difficult airway course for free. And so, and I just actually got the last class roster. We still have some spots left. If you happen to be, I don't know when you produce the podcast, Chris, but
it'll come out Friday.
Then you're not, then what a great airway course you're going to miss.
Oh, sorry.
But, the airwaysite.com is the website. Wherever you are, if you're in pre-hospital or if you're an emergency medicine physician that listens to this podcast, Ron Walls and the people that have developed this course are very passionate about airway. And even though we happen to have the GlideScope Rangers at our service, we still encourage our people to go through this difficult airway class because it is not only the intellectual approach to managing the airway, but the hands-on approach as well. And I can't recommend it enough. We're going to be doing it this Friday and Saturday at the Medical Center of the Rockies.
And, you know, I'm up here in Nova Scotia right now, and we were talking to their training and, well, their clinical care coordinator, which was pretty awesome, that I loved today, he was handing out, well, yeah, we're working on the difficult airway and the lemon and blah. I'm like, wow, cool. It's up here, too. So it's everywhere. It's good. So,
That's great, Buck,
what are you doing, man? Anything new?
We got the EMS Educast this Thursday, and depending on when you put this up, when it's available, when people download it, if you're listening to this and it's not yet Thursday Mountain Standard Time 7 or Eastern Standard Time 9, stop what you're doing and listen to the EMS Educast live. As we put on a link, and actually we'll be able to take callers. The way to do this is to go to emseducast.com, click on our live page at, like I said, it's 7 Mountain, 9 Eastern, and there will be instructions there about how to hook up, and there will be a little, you're going to go through talkshoe.com, and if you have a headset, and you go and download the TalkShoe software, you'll actually be able to call in and talk to us, or you can even do it via cell phone. There'll be some instructions on this, so go and have a look at it. And this is something we're thinking about doing for other shows, even this one, although we were breaking it tonight. It was too much with Chris being in Nova Scotia. We couldn't get it going on. But we tried this experiment last week, and it was all jacked up because I was making it too complicated. I found a really simple way to do it, and now it works. So please join us, and we're starting a whole month-long diatribe, I think, about field internship training. And so come join us there. And, of course, you can always see me at Twitter at Buckman, and you can catch me on my not-so-serious blog at gomerville.com.
And I'm saying bye for Fergus, because he said, I got to go, good night. So he's gone. Oh. And Gary, what about you? Where are you off to next?
I'm home till Monday, and then I'll be going to D.C. for the NEMSAC meeting next week. There should be some nice stuff coming out of NEMSAC once the minutes are made public after next week. But now that I've heard there's a Pooter Junction, I think I'm going to have to look that place up and make a trip.
Pooter Valley.
Pooter Valley.
Oh, my God.
That just sounds dirty. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to end this podcast. Thanks for joining us on this EMS. I almost said EMS Educast. EMS Garage. Join us next week when we can bring you more fun, I hope, and news and information. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.